if you want people to respect the office of minister, warden, sacrament, then you better look like you know what you're doing. And part of that in this culture is the uniform of that office.
Yeah.
It used to be a clerical attire. But I think it's very, very important that ministers dress appropriately to their office so that a coat and tie, at least in our circles, conveys the idea that, look, I'm taking this seriously. This is the uniform of authority, not because I'm any big shot, but because right. I'm taking what I do seriously, and I should wear the appropriate uniform for that particular call.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another broadcast of the White Horse Inn. Our topic tonight, radical informality.
Cool!
One of the things I picked up on from my time of living in England was just how informal we Americans are by comparison. In ways that I did not even know that I was informal. Even in news reporting, an appropriate prefix, Mr., Dr., Mrs., was always employed in the UK, while in America, even the president's called Bush in U.S. newspapers. Maybe it's the radical egalitarianism, you know, the philosophy that all people are not only created equal before God and the law, but in every other aspect of life. Students are just as competent as teachers. Pastors often see themselves as competent to address matters about which some of their parishioners know a whole lot more, while parishioners return the favor by treating Pastor Bob as if he's one of the boys, no more qualified than they are to expound and apply the scriptures. This radical leveling means that conversation in almost every realm today looks more like an Oprah show than anything else. Just as every person has an equal vote, everyone and every idea is equal as well. If anything, internet has probably pushed this informality and egalitarianism to its limits. Whereas before, writers had peers in their professions reviewing their work, judging its merits, demanding high standards of research and argument. Now anybody can share his or her thoughts about the world and send it, unedited, to anyone in the world. Increasingly, even classical music, the academy, and literature now conform to the generic tastes of mass popular consumer culture. Well, now, not all of this is bad, of course. The gospel can thrive in any culture, but that doesn't mean that all cultures are equally good or that they're neutral in their effects on the church. That's what we want to talk about in this edition of the White Horse Inn with your usual conversation partners here at the Inn. Dr. Kim Riddlebarger is pastor of Christ Reformed Church in Anaheim, California. The Reverend Ken Jones is pastor of Greater Union Baptist Church in Compton, California. And Dr. Rod Rosenblatt is on the line with us in Oregon, beautiful Oregon. Dr. Rod Rosenblatt teaches theology at Concordia University in Irvine. I'm Mike Horton, and I teach at Westminster Seminary, California. You want to talk about how trends are changing, like the 1960s revolution against formality, revolution against that went on into the 70s, the gift that kept on giving. Now, a Berkeley professor, John McWhorter, in his book, Doing Our Own Thing, The Degradation of Language and Music and Why We Should Like Care.
That's a great book, by the way.
Is it?
Yeah.
Writes that if we went back in time to 1863 and hung out with the average family who attended the lengthy speech of popular orator Edward Everett just before Lincoln read his famous Gettysburg Address, quote, most of us would be squirming a half hour into Everett's speech, desperate after an hour, sobbing quietly after an hour and a half, and needing therapy by the time he finished. But our hosts, while perhaps flagging a tad as the second hour wore on, would be engaged with Everett's words with a sincere lustiness at the end, as happy they came as we would be attending a taping of Letterman. What is it about us? And then in contrast to this, McWhorter describes his own teaching style at Berkeley in our own day. Quote, I strive for a casual tone in my undergraduate lectures and would never dream of reciting my lectures from notes or even speaking to classes in language anything less than breezy and accessible, end quote. In fact, he argues that since the 1960s, quote, fancy talk came to seem corny and backward, compared to loosening up and telling it like it is. And people suckled on the old style rhetoric, let it go. People who were brought up on that old style rhetoric just let it go.
Wow.
Very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've mentioned my time in Oxford. Still to this day, you wear your gowns on a lot of occasions. The dons, your professors and instructors, wear their gowns as they're lecturing. You know, you think of gowns in the pulpit.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to all have differing views about what's appropriate. Certainly, no one could ever walk into a classroom and teach without a tie and a suit 30 years ago. But does that mean that we have to today? It's obviously significant that informality is now the norm.
Yeah.
But how do we decide these matters?
Well, I think historically, Americans hate authority figures. It goes back to our colonial days.
To the founding.
It goes back to the founding of this nation. The idea that no king's going to tell us.
Exactly.
And that's part of the American soul.
And no pope over us.
And no pope over us as well. And on the one hand, as an American, that strikes a deep chord in me. And yet, we've reached the point now, Mike, as you point out, where this kind of, it's gotten beyond greasy familiarity. Mm-hmm. It's gone beyond that now to no authority whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we weren't going to have a king, at least we'd have a legislature, an elected person.
Yeah.
And now we have a difficult time even accepting the authority of elected officials. It used to be that we wouldn't have a pope, but we'd at least have a reverend doctor in our pulpit. And now it's Billy Bob, who's just like the rest of us. We've so followed that course that we're down to.
It's interesting that we don't do that, for instance, with our medical doctors. We still call them, you know, Dr. Smith or Dr. Jones. And if a doctor comes knife in hand to work on me, he better not be wearing a Hawaiian shirt.
I was just going to say, the last time, you know, a doctor comes in his Hawaiian shirt, it's hard to call him doctor anymore.
Yeah, or to take him seriously.
Take him seriously, sure.
And yet that's often what happens in the pulpit. We want to be one of the guys.
Yep.
You know, we want to... But you know, a doctor, medical doctor, doesn't try to be one of the guys. A judge, you know, what would we do if a Supreme Court justice walked out in a muumuu, you know?
Or what would you do if the president gave the State of the Union address in a T-shirt?
Yeah,
you know,
because he really wanted to connect with America.
But you know, that's... even with the informality that's all over the place in the news and in politics and so forth, when you go into the halls of Congress, there is still a decorum. There's there's still a hierarchy. That sort of public ritual is still somewhat present.
And the thing is, at least in American forms of informality and in other cultures as well, it was because of the office. And certainly historically in at least Protestant churches, it wasn't because of the person. It was because of the office. Today, whether we're talking about national leaders, governors, presidents, whether we're talking about our pastors, our informality really makes it difficult for us to distinguish the office from the person. So if you don't like the pastor of your church, then for whatever reasons his putting himself personally forward has meant, then you go to another church where you like this pastor better. Yeah. You like his personality or what have you. But if the minister is not preaching himself but Christ, and the office is what is important rather than the person, you have a completely different situation, don't you?
Yeah, and I would even extend that to dress in worship. You know, I grew up in a culture where it was common to dress up to go to church. And if you were a man, you wore a tie.
Go to meeting clothes.
Exactly.
Yeah, go to meeting clothes.
Or as my great-grandfather once told me when I was about 6 years old in Arkansas, I said, you know, because I'm watching him all week long in overalls and so forth as he worked on his farm. And I asked him, well, why are you getting so dressed up? And he says, because we're going to the king's house.
Yeah.
And so there's the idea, and of course there are some other cultural things that were related. The only time and place where you could dress up and be seen, and so you'd go to these churches, and the women had hats on, and they dressed nice. They dressed in a way that they didn't dress when they were around the house. And then when I was about 12 years old, we worshiped with an Anglo Baptist church from Southern Orange County. And the people came, and the women wore pants, the guys wore jeans, and so forth. And it was just a culture shock to see people come into worship dressed like that.
Yeah,
I mean, I just couldn't believe
that. That started here with the Jesus People movement, because the same churches where you see this kind of Orange County informality and beachwear is not only in the business world, it's also in the church. And that just comes from this kind of Orange County where you've got the tanning booth and the Mercedes and all that. It's all part of an image that people bear. And they carry that over in a church because that image is a successful image.
Yeah. Okay, well, why is that image any different from, aren't we just talking about two cultural forms? In the 1950s, it was Mr. and Mrs. Cleaver. You never saw Ward out of his suit, and you never saw June without her pearls, yeah. Even if she was washing dishes.
Yeah, exactly.
So how much of this is, you know, you guys are just stodgy.
I can only go back to my university days with Dr. O, who was the dean of the School of Business, and he would give this lecture to all the freshmen in the School of Business. If you not know what you're doing, you work like you know what you're doing. And that has always stuck with me, that you know, part of the if you want people to respect the office of minister, ward, and sacrament, then you better look like you know what you're doing. And part of that in this culture is the uniform of that office.
Yeah.
It used to be a clerical attire. But I think it's very, very important that ministers dress appropriately to their office so that a coat and tie, at least in our circles, conveys the idea that, look, I'm taking this seriously. This is the uniform of authority, not because I'm any big shot, but because I'm taking what I do seriously, and I should wear the appropriate uniform for that particular call. I wear a pulpit robe for that very reason, and I put it on before I go into the pulpit, and I take it off when I'm out.
Right.
You have bad ties.
Because I have bad ties.
T. David Gordon, a friend of ours, a minister and professor at Grove City College, has written a manuscript I really hope he publishes soon, Why Johnny Can't Preach, where he talks about a lot of the cultural reasons why we have bad preaching, not just theological, but cultural reasons. And he makes mention of the fact that in his own tradition, they used to publish the correspondence. You can find this. Charles Scribner and Sons, New York, published correspondence of Presbyterian ministers.
Boy, what a great straight line. I'll leave that one.
And T. David Gordon says, can you imagine today publishing the email and the phone messages of Presbyterian ministers, or listening to their phone conversations back and forth to each other today, where it's pidgin English? I mean, it's really, we have come to replace reflection and wisdom, trying to express things well, with trying to say things quickly to get things done, haven't we?
Yeah, that's so true.
It certainly is for me.
But I guess the whole idea of public discourse has changed over the years. I mean, there was a distinction between public conversation or public discourse and private conversation, or even or correspondence. People spoke differently. We wrote differently. And even if you look at the old movies from the 30s and 40s, the language was so lavish. It was far different from any way that we would speak. And that the whole idea of being more colloquial or being more down to earth in our speech, it's carried over into every realm of discourse.
I think T. David makes a great point. We used to keep personal correspondence. If you have grandparents, you know, when you clean out their estate, sadly, you'll find boxes of letters because letters were important. They were timeless documents, and they would convey information that people needed to know. It was important to keep them.
It was an art form,
even for
people who didn't think of it that
way.
Yeah,
exactly. And today, I mean, we just don't even think in those categories anymore.
And an email is not to be confused with a letter. I mean, it's a different form of communication, and so it's not going to be as elaborate as a letter would be.
Yeah,
I think it's just the orthography.
You're right.
I have a pastor friend back in Indiana who found stacks full of teenagers' examinations bound into books. I asked if I could have one. He said, sure, I have a closet full of them. Just the ability to write English, to lay it down on paper. Think of if you get a letter from a European. Just the orthography.
Yeah, right.
But I think even deeper than this, the radical informality is an overlay of we're not teaching our kids to think. I'm not saying that of Christians. I think we're doing it better than some of the secular people. But Orwell's nightmare was that when we couldn't say something with precision, our thoughts weren't precise.
Mm-hmm.
And I meet with a generation, you guys do too, I meet with a generation that's never been forced to think.
So when we don't think, what we express are our emotions rather than our thoughts.
Yeah. And look at our own kids, all the multitasking they do. They can't be thinking because they're doing so many things at once.
And almost have to be in order to do any one of those things.
Yeah, exactly.
We love distraction.
You just go back to, like I said, the old art of letter writing, Rod, your point. The care that went into, you know, if you weren't sitting at a computer screen or you could backspace and erase and you had your pen out and you had paper and you had to, you know, put your thoughts from ink to paper, you had to think about what you were going to write.
Exactly.
You had to be careful. And yet when you sit at a computer terminal, man, it's so easy to be careless and flip. And
an email is something you think of something at the moment, you jot something down or you type it in real quick and you'll hear back
instantaneously.
Yeah. But Rod, don't you think there's a correlation between our inability to write with our inability to speak and the failure to read?
Yes.
I think
the schools destroy the kids' interest in reading if the parents haven't.
And also the writing. I mean, when was the last time any of us received a personal letter or wrote one?
The only times I get personal letters anymore are from inmates.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they don't have access to a computer terminal. Everyone else, it's an email.
And you'll notice that those letters that you get, because I get them all the time from inmates, and I get a lot of letters also from African pastors, they are more detailed.
Yes.
Yeah, that is interesting. That's very interesting. Friends I keep in touch with in England write these letters with, once again, Rod, you mentioned the orthography. It looks like a piece of art.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they consider the form to be that important to concentrate on, the content is so much richer.
Yeah.
I've asked my students, did you ever in your schooling have a course, young on, where you learned to practice writing? They said no. And now it's gotten worse. I had a student look me straight in the face and say, but I never had a course in grammar, Dr. Rosenblatt.
Mm. Wow. And see, this isn't elitism, because what we're saying is people who didn't graduate from high school a generation or two ago were better at this than I am.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Another one that I sort of kept was an eighth grade examination from the turn of the century. I'm not sure I could pass it.
Wow.
It gives you a whole new idea of what it means to talk about former generations as, well, she didn't get to go to high school even.
Yeah, when you grade papers from students, some of whom include Ivy League educated young people, and you shake your head saying, this wouldn't have passed the eighth grade a generation ago.
That's right.
It's really amazing how far we've fallen. So informality is certainly a part of it. It's not the whole thing. And we're not saying, are we, oh, for the good old days when men wore suits to a baseball game.
Yeah, and we all speak Shakespearean English.
Yeah,
right.
No, I don't think that's the case at all, but I do think we need to pay attention to the transition.
Yeah.
Well, or the loss of times where it is appropriate to wear a suit and a tie.
Yeah.
Or the distinction between the mundane and an important occasion where it is the old-fashioned manners.
Kim, that is such an important point, because we can certainly say, if you're at a picnic, don't wear a suit. That's strange.
Right.
If you're, you know, there are all kinds of places where even greater formality than we used to have is probably a good thing.
I'm not wearing my Hawaiian shirt in the pulpit, because when I'm in the pulpit, I'm preaching God's word. When I go to the swap meet, when I do whatever else, fine, then wear the Hawaiian shirt.
It's really interesting when, you know, you're asked to preach a wedding for people who are in, let's say, a tradition where the pastor wears a Hawaiian shirt on Sunday. The couple asks you to wear a robe for their wedding. You better wear a robe.
Very interesting. Well, I think that even if we've lost this on Sunday mornings, the place that it comes to meet us, and especially our children notice it, is a funeral.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Could you
absolutely.
Imagine, I'm just happy all the time. Yeah. I'm,
well,
you know,
I've been to
the happy days are here again.
I get, have
it's
the,
happening.
The misfortune of attend. Well, I have had to attend a lot of funerals for members of our congregation, especially their parents will die. And there have been several of late where, you know, they're celebrations and the minister yeah. is in a his Hawaiian shirt or whatever. And
really?
It's like you can't face death. So you turn it into with balloons and all kinds of other stuff, wow. and you just
that
think,
would offend non. You would
it
think,
offended me.
Yeah, you would think though that that would actually offend non-Christians who would say, "I think he was being disrespectful." Mm-hmm. I almost wonder if the only people who wouldn't be offended by that are Christians who have been so dumbed down by regular church attendance, where this mm-hmm. informality yeah. Yeah. now dominates. Whereas non-Christians who haven't been to church in years might say, I'm personally offended. The guy didn't even bother to dress up for this person's
well,
funeral.
Well, I think...
You know, this is not at all my area of expertise, but there's a window of the post-millennials coming, and they're going to be looking for, if they can find one, a cathedral. Certainly stained glass. If they can find a place where there's an organ, that's a plus, not a minus. The pastor should be in robes, and there should be a real historic liturgy. I don't know how long that's going to last, but the ones like my church that have hitched their wagon to the star of 1960s contemporary worship are going to be completely ignored by these kids. Mm-hmm. They will come to the door, hear the drums in the background, go back to their car and say mm-hmm. to one another, maybe we still have time to find a church.
Yeah, it really is these younger generations, people in these younger generations who are saying, you know, enough of the dog and pony show. I want transcendence. I want a God who is great and majestic and different from me.
Yes.
You know, I think we, as you talk about this, I think of something else, that the informality that has infiltrated the church is not a neutral act. It's not neutral, but it really is almost a revolution against authority.
Okay. Against God's authority.
Exactly. Biblical authority, the authority of God himself, and almost revolting against any idea of otherness or holiness, transcendent holiness.
If you are so informal that you're up there in your Hawaiian shirt doing your lounge lizard imitation, it's very hard to say, thus saith the Lord,
right,
and have people look at you with any kind of...
But that's not the point. The point now of a lot of ministers, we've so, again, this shows that it's not value neutral. There are theological things going on here. If you don't believe that the most important thing that happens on Sunday morning is that God shows up
right,
and summons his people to his throne and blesses them and gives them his law, gives them his gospel, if you don't believe that the most important thing that happens there is that through the office of the ministry, God is taking his people in hand in judgment and justification, then it really does become all about me and me connecting with the people, dressing down mm-hmm. and being one of the guys coming down out of the pulpit, walking around the crowd. And my charisma, rather than my office,
exactly.
becomes
exactly
what
right.
it's all about.
It's exactly right.
And now I share my thoughts informally instead of declaring God's word formally.
Uh-huh. See, that's a new sort of strange fire that's being
yeah.
offered.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, Ken.
It's like
the restaurants years ago. I've only seen them on television where they want such an informal atmosphere that if you go in with a tie, they cut it.
Yeah.
That's an intentional act.
Right.
And so this idea of informality, it's part of the worldliness that has affected Christianity, that we are like the world. So because I don't call my boss Mr. Johnson, I call him Bob instead. I can now call my pastor Bob. I think it's an intentional act.
Yeah. And you look at the generations here, the older folks in the church, they would never think of not calling the pastor pastor, even if they are out on the golf course.
Yes. Mm.
Yeah, that really came home to me when I pastored my parents. And in the church, my mother was real good at this. She never called me anything but pastor.
Mm. Uh-huh.
at church.
Good for her.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was precious outside of church.
Outside of church, it was something altogether different. But in church, it was always pastor.
Pastor precious.
Because it's the office. And I bristle at it. When people call me pastor or reverend or doctor or whatever, I bristle
I
at
do too.
It. But that's actually not a sign of humility. It's a sign of pride because I'm saying, I want you to view me in my person rather than in my office. And it's actually humbler to say, you know what, I'm going to let you call me that because I am nothing, but my office is something.
Yeah, you have to learn to do that. It's hard.
It's interesting. Gorbachev, one of undoubtedly the five or six most important, significant, weighty figures in the 20th century, in 1997 was shilling for Pizza Hut in a TV commercial. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Here he is sitting with a little girl eating pizza and doing an ad for Pizza Hut. And people asked him, do you think this weakens your coinage just a little bit? He said, if my name works for the benefit of consumers, to hell with it.
Wow. Capitalism is a good thing.
It's been very, very good to me.
Capitalism is very, very good to me. Hmm.
That's the attitude a lot of pastors are taking.
Yeah.
And you know what? Sorry. God's more important than you are. And you represent him. You speak for him. He doesn't speak for you.
Yeah, it becomes another way of sort of taming God and taming the atmosphere for God. It's almost, the opposite of what Paul says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. We shouldn't be ashamed of the authority that we represent. Mm-hmm.
But then we all know ministers who'd wear two ties and two robes if they could.
Right.
there are guys who are insecure and love the authority and lord it over people, and they give everybody else a bad name.
I had somebody at the college say to me, it was with respect, well, I had heard that you were against authority, and I appreciated him saying it. I said, actually, I'm not, but I'm against bad authority.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, and isn't that exactly why we don't make things turn on the person but the office? Because if things are set up right, we would say in a constitutional republic, the way the Constitution sets it up.
Uh-huh.
In the church, the way our church orders set them up, if things run properly, then a person who doesn't deserve to hold authority doesn't. And there's a way of getting a person who is being tyrannical or in other ways mischievous out of that office. Whereas if you focus on the person, as long as he can get enough people behind him because of his charisma, you're in trouble.
Yes. Yeah, I hope that holds true in more cases than I've actually seen it work, but I sure hope so.
Well, what are some of the values on which informality depends? Again, people will say, I want people to hear what we're not saying. We're not saying, are we, that as a result of this program, everyone should wear a tie to church next Sunday.
No.
What we're saying here is it's not neutral. There's something going on here that really has fundamental implications both for the culture and for the church. We need to understand that, but we also need to not come up with the 10 tips for dressing.
Well, as far as the dress of the people, I think we can begin as church leaders of making sure that we have, for lack of a better term, a holy atmosphere, that it's not a secular atmosphere.
Exactly. That's a great point.
And see how people respond to the atmosphere.
Interesting.
When I was young, you wouldn't find the sanctuary filled with people who were jabbering.
Yeah. Mm.
A silence came over them as they walked into the sanctuary.
But there was a communion
table. Sanctuary that lent itself to that.
Yeah.
But there was a communion table and a pulpit there.
There was an altar, yes.
Yes, altar, whatever. Yeah. But it didn't bring back scenes of the mall.
No.
Exactly. That's the point.
If you see a drum set up there, you feel like you're walking into a concert.
Of course.
Or if it looks like a theater, what do people do? Well, actually, people are quieter when they walk into a theater.
They are.
Except for all the cell phones going off. That's the other thing. And there's just the idea that this is not sacred space for a particular time. So there's no differentiation between this or going to the theater.
Yes. Yeah. Mike, and you mentioned earlier the pulpit. What a piece of architecture that's passing away.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the values that underlie all of this. First of all, speed, which is part of pragmatism, versus patience, which involves wisdom. That's got to be a major contrast here that undergirds the informality, right?
Let's get right to it and get it over with.
Exactly.
Yeah. Net it out for me.
My attention span is 32.3 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got about 12 minutes to win me over, and if not, I'm going down the street.
Versus patience, which requires wisdom. Hmm. Wisdom can't come. Nothing really important when you think about it. A good marriage, a good wine, nothing really, a good book, can't be read or written quickly.
Things microwave that are, popcorn would be an exception.
Well, there you
that.
Go. That is okay. That's a pretty good point. How about innovation versus tradition?
Well, if you're preaching to consumers rather than disciples, you got to keep their attention, and that requires constant innovation. They have to have something new and different. Every time you get together, you're going to lose them.
Whereas tradition, again, takes time and wisdom to develop, and you can have bad traditions, but you won't have any traditions. You won't have anything of depth. That's what we mean by tradition. You won't have anything that can be conveyed over time from generation to generation if innovation rather than wisdom.
You know, it's a good point, Mike, and I think that most Americans don't realize that if we lose all tradition, we are really lost. I don't think that's part of the thought today.
Well, tradition, like authority, has become a bad word.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yes.
It's automatically associated with traditionalism.
Well, and this is not your father's Oldsmobile.
Yeah.
But what do you do with a faith that is passed down from generation to generation?
Right.
If everything we're doing in the church is based on saying, this is not your father's Oldsmobile, this is not church the way it used to be.
Uh-huh.
How about egalitarianism versus expertise?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so many situations arise where you'll have somebody who's a very good guitar player is all of a sudden the minister of music.
Or not so good guitar player is the minister
three chords
of music.
That's a real problem. People can master the trade in 2 weeks, and we turn them loose and stick them in a pulpit in front of the plexiglass, whatever that thing is, the lectern, and then let them tell their story.
Well, and a lot of people will say, I don't need to go to seminary. I had a radical conversion, and every time I've given my testimony, lots of people have responded, and I'm a good communicator, and so they spend 2 weeks with a big-name pastor somewhere up in the mountains. And they come down and they plant their own church. And suddenly they are pastors. And, I mean, you don't need expertise. You don't need to know the biblical languages. You don't need to know church history so that you don't completely make every mistake that has been made for the last 2,000 years.
Lord called me.
I had this burning in the bosom. And here I am. I've got the right techniques and the right charisma. Expertise doesn't count much in this culture, except when our bodies are on the line. We don't want to say, I have this great doctor. You know, when I'm in his office, I feel like he really knows me. Or, you know, she's really tender. She's really a sweet person. You know, that's how we talk about our pastors.
Yeah.
Or he gives me really good advice. No, I want a doctor who's been to Stanford, for Pete's sake. I want a doctor who actually knows how to carve me up so that I'll live afterwards. And, you know, a bad pastor can kill you.
Yep.
Expertise matters, doesn't
it? It really does.
How about another contrasting value underneath this informality? Convenience versus respect.
Oof. It goes back to the whole consumerism in the culture. People want to get through something with as much rapidity and as little commitment as possible. Hmm. And so it better be right there, easy, available.
Accessible.
Prepackaged, accessible. I can get it all in 15 minutes and I'm on to the next thing.
So what have you done for me lately? What can you do for me today? Have you got something for me that I can take away immediately?
The demand for practical preaching with lots and lots and lots of application fits in that. Where people want to be, give me the three things. Don't bother me with the theoretical. Give me the three steps I can do to fix this now.
And I want stories about the preacher, you know, autobiography, where once again, the person and not the office is what's really key. That's the informality, isn't it?
I think you hit on it earlier, Mike, when you talked about the importance of recovering the notion of being God-centered in our thinking and doing as Christians, as opposed to centering things upon ourselves. And that really is the heart of the issue.
Well, and making a differentiation between sacred space and common space. When you come into the church, it is sacred space, and it's God's sacred space. So therefore, it is His word. This is
His office.
What
does He say? What is His will?
And as ministers, it is our responsibility to remember that we are feeding His sheep.
Yeah, that's a great point, Ken.
And not winning our own support.
Nor building our own little kingdom.
Our own little empires, yeah.
So if all of that, a sense of the holiness and transcendence of God, a sense of the holiness of the office of the ministry of word and sacrament, the set apartness of the people of God and the worship of God, if we really took all of that seriously, then we wouldn't start by sitting around a table and figuring out what kind of rules we would impose on people about how they should dress.
Right.
You know, whether women could wear pants, as was the case in the churches I grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
But people would make their own decisions, and there would be plenty of diversity in how they thought about that. But at least a sense that something is going on here that is not decided by a fraternity or sorority. This is something
if
that
we would introduce these sorts of themes, the young would notice because they're already noticing outside the church.
That's a great point, Rod, and I think that's why if we as ministers take our calls seriously and behave in ways that are appropriate to that office, the congregation will notice and follow along. We don't have to tell them what to wear.
No.
But if we are being serious about our calling and setting the appropriate tenor and tone for what we're doing, the congregation will notice and will gladly follow.
Yeah, and there is a trickle-down theory that really is true.
Sure.
That is that the parents will pick this up. The children get it primarily there, and it isn't. Mm-hmm. And it isn't a whole list of rules. It's an inner sort of approach, as Ken says, to sacred space.
Well, mentioning the parents, now this brings up another issue. We are talking about parents in many instances that have already jettisoned parental authority. They are trying to be their children's friend.
I agree.
Instead of establishing, you know, a relationship where they are the authority figure and the child is subordinate to that.
I totally agree. And in other words, this is going to be a Copernican shift.
Yes.
Yeah, it will be.
The problem there, too, is that young people cannot live in that kind of authority vacuum.
That's right.
So they are ripe for the cults. They're ripe for
gangs.
Gangs.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're ripe for authoritarianism.
Yep.
Islam.
Exactly.
Yes.
If they don't have authorities. And that brings us back to the point that really, you know, God is the archetype here. Everything we're talking about is the copy. And so if God is the authority figure we're talking about, we're not talking about authoritarianism. We're talking about an authority that saves us from every authoritarianism.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And if we take that seriously again, our whole understanding of authority and formality will be transformed.
That's right.
Well, and along the way, Mike, that requires, especially ministers of the gospel, to teach people why things are done.
Yes.
So that people understand that there are biblical reasons and there's a rationale for this, that this isn't my whim, nor is it my own authority.
Yeah. Do you guys have issues that come up over things that are neither biblically commanded nor forbidden?
Adiaphora, sure.
Adiaphora?
Yeah.
Because there, if we're drawing the distinction between what counts and what doesn't really count, that in itself starts a wisdom.
Absolutely.
Mm, yep.
Absolutely. In things indifferent, we're not free to do whatever we want. We're free to be guided by wisdom.
Right.
Exactly.
So, folks, you know, all the stuff that we take really seriously requires some kind of formal commitment. Everything that is really important to us, a marriage, friendship, relationships of every kind, becoming a member of a church. Well, that's formal. Yes, it is formal. It demands something of you. It means that you are taking this seriously.
Patience, commitment.
Patience, commitment, catechizing your children at home, catechizing them at church. These are all activities that require values of patience, values of discipleship, values of expertise, values of tradition, values of respect, a opposed to the values of our culture, a culture of consumerism, convenience, egalitarianism, innovation, and speed. The Christian faith, no less than the culture, really needs to think deeply about these things, because our faith requires that we pass this thing down from generation to generation. Well, we certainly haven't settled anything. We've just opened the door to, hopefully, discussion in your own homes and churches about these important matters. And we look forward to being with you again next week on The White Horse Inn.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about supporting our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.